Illinois missed its first payment to K-12 public schools yesterday for the first time in history because Republicans and Democrats can't agree on what to do about school funding in Senate Bill 1. State Senator Andy Menar is the architect behind SB 1. He joins us in studio.
We have been debating this issue for decades in Illinois, and as the debate has raged on, inequity has gotten progressively worse. And if the debate continues, we should only acknowledge that the inequity in the state at this time next year will be worse than it is today, which means that we would allow the hole to get bigger and wider before we decide to get out of it.
Plus, one of the many things to look forward to at the state fair is the food. And if you really love fair food, there's a new eating competition.
The rules are, if a competitor regurgitates any food, they will be disqualified. Stuff like watermelon should be relatively easy to eat. We can't eat enough watermelon in 5 minutes to throw up, I hope.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Special thanks to Scott Cameron for filling in for me while I was away. From the budget crisis to the school funding crisis, Illinois has gone from one drawn-out political fight to another. K-12 schools were supposed to receive their first payments from the state yesterday, but the General Assembly and Governor Rauner have not yet agreed on how to do that. Last month's state budget said the government would not fund schools unless it changes the way it calculates how to dole out that money in what's being called an evidence-based formula. That formula was baked into Senate Bill 1, SB 1, you've heard a lot about, passing the House and the Senate. But Governor Rauner sent it back and made lots of changes using an amendatory veto. Now it's up to the State House to decide whether or not to accept those changes or override them, which will start, that process will start on Sunday. Senator Andy Menar is a Democrat representing Bunker Hill, Illinois' 48th district. He's the lawmaker behind SB 1. He was in Urbana yesterday, and I spoke with him from our studios there yesterday afternoon. Senator, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we're speaking on the day that Illinois was supposed to make its first payments to K-12 schools. Do you feel like state government has already failed its citizens in this regard?
I think the state government has failed its citizens for years when it comes to school funding. I think what has happened, going back to last week when the governor vetoed Senate Bill 1, that took us down a path that, frankly, we didn't have to go down. Senate Bill 1 has been a work in progress now for many years in terms of the recent effort to reform school funding. But this is an effort that has transpired decades. So, it's a fair question to say, is it a failure to not pay schools for the first time in history on the date that general state aid is due to them? The answer is yes. But I would also say that this is a long string of failures that has resulted in the least equitable system of school funding in the country, which we own today in the state.
You just came from a news conference in Urbana with several school superintendents and some of your state house colleagues. What are school districts saying to you about how all this is unfolding?
Well, over the past week and a half, I and my colleagues in both the House and the Senate, we've traveled the state and we've had open town hall meetings and listening meetings and press conferences and webinars and Facebook Live events. And we're hearing the same thing. And that was reinforced in Urbana today. And I think it's important to say that whether it's coming from teachers or parents or reform organizations, they want it fixed. They want the school funding problem in the state of Illinois, both the immediate problem, which is upcoming now that school is starting, and the long-term problem, which has been festering for decades. They want it fixed, and they want it fixed once and for all.
Senator, as you said, you've been working on this for years. I wonder if you can explain to people some of the terms that we're hearing a lot in SB 1, particularly this idea of an evidence-based funding model. What does that mean?
Well, it's fairly straightforward. What the model does and what the proponents of this model, and I think it's important to note that I was not an early proponent of the evidence-based model, but because of the work that had been done by educators across the state, I became a proponent. And I've been completely sold that this is the way we should go. The model is quite simple. It measures what success takes in terms of dollars, and it applies that measurement to the entire state. And it measures, for example, the needs of school districts through the unique needs of each child that they are charged with educating. And we compound that for each school district, and we devote money appropriately. It's a very good way to approach this, because we actually put a dollar amount on what success ought to cost the state, and correspondingly how the state should invest in public education. We know, for example, that smaller class sizes at younger years and younger grades produces better results down the road. So we incentivize those types of things in this formula. So truly, for the first time in history, we have a measurement of what each school district needs to get the outcomes that we expect of them, as opposed to the current system, which treats school districts the same, whether they have a 4% poverty rate, for example, or a 99% poverty rate. We look at those two districts today the same way, and we expect the same outcomes when we know that's setting them up for failure. So the evidence-based funding model is developed by educators. It was written by educators in the state, and it makes a true measurement of what the cost of success is and distributes those monies appropriately.
Right. So you mentioned class size ratio. There's about two dozen items, right, that go into this?
Yes, 27.
So there's a 27, and then you kind of do a ratio also based on, as you said, the demographic differences, what the income sort of levels are of those schools. Can you give us an idea of what of these other things? So class size ratio is important. What are a couple other things that go into the formula?
For example, if a student has a IEP or is a special ed student, that is a cost factor that we have to appropriately build into any model. We do that in the evidence-based model in Senate Bill 1. If a student is bilingual, for example, that's another factor that contributes to the cost of the education of that child to get the positive outcome that we want. We appropriately acknowledge that. There's many others. Whether or not a child needs what we call wraparound services, because in many districts, as we know, especially in downstate, those things are cut immediately. Social workers, guidance counselors. All of those things are costed out for the first time in very specific ways. Educators literally sat down and said, what does a successful school model look like, and how do we attach state investment to that? That is essentially what the evidence-based model's done, and that is, worlds away from where we are today in the state. And if we stick to this model over time, we can guarantee that school districts will be both adequately funded and equitably funded. We will go from last in the country to first in the country, and then most of all, we will have better outcomes from public schools in all parts of the state.
Senator Menard, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about all of the things that you've really obviously spent. I'm thinking of the first time I talked to you about this, which I feel like it was maybe like 4 or 5 years ago.
We
were sitting in Springfield, and we were sitting in the Capitol talking about this. Why is this so important to you?
Because I know that the system today is broken, and I see time and again for years, probably decades, going back to when Governor Edgar put his plan on the table in the late 1990s. I happened to be in the House chamber that day. I was shadowing my state senator at the time, State Senator Vince DiMuzio from Carlinville, who, of course, was a lion for downstate Illinois in the state Senate, who had a good working relationship with Governor Edgar in the opposite party. But that was, the second time I had stepped foot into the Capitol, and I heard Governor Edgar's words outlining just the gross immoral inequities in public school finance in the state of Illinois. And fast forward a couple of decades, nothing has changed. Over time, there was a patchwork put together, and the governor's plan at the time was well thought out, and it did work for several years, but then the state became different, and it became very different in terms of its economy and its ability to raise local wealth through taxation, all the while we're spending money the same way. So from a public policy and being an elected official perspective, that's one kind of track that I land on. The other is I'm a father of three children that go to the same elementary school that I went to. And I see what is happening in my hometown, and I see those same things happening in small towns all over Illinois today. It's a slow death, a slow decline of opportunity through public education. That's the direct result of inaction in state government. So those are the two parallel paths that I view myself on, both a father and an elected official. And it's important to me that we right this wrong. This wrong literally weighs on my conscience because it is so wrong in the state. The disparity between African-American students and white students, the disparity between wealthy school districts and poor districts, the opportunities that come out or don't come out of public schools because of the inability of the state to reform this age-old public policy question. It has to change. And it's not just me. You know, there's dozens of lawmakers who are working on this, and we are bound and determined to change it once and for all.
Senator Menard, it's also put you on a path in direct opposition to the governor. He and other critics have repeatedly characterized this as a bailout for Chicago and for CPS. And I want to go through some of the things that he did in the amendatory veto and ask you about them. There's sure. So many more moving parts here. And I think one that's got a lot of attention in the past few days have been who pays for pensions for new teachers and how that affects the amount of money districts get. Mm-hmm. And this is a little complicated, but under the amended bill, local districts will have to pay for new teacher pensions, but the state won't take that into account when they decide how much overall funding each district will get. How do you think that would affect especially lower income districts?
It will harm those districts. And that is kind of the cord of changes or similar to that. The governor makes over 100 changes to Senate
Bill 1. So not just Chicago is
correct.
Your point.
Yeah. And, you know, think about it. If the costs of pensions for teachers, which today is paid for by the state budget, is shifted over time to local school districts, but we don't account for that cost in terms of what's necessary to adequately fund a school district, that is going to harm the districts that are furthest away from being adequately funded. So that change, that one change alone, and there's many, many others in the veto, that one change alone would put the burden of the difference between the two on the least funded school districts in the state.
Another issue is TIF districts. It's tax increment financing. Let's not get into exactly what those are. We could spend 20 minutes talking about that. But I think the important thing is that the amendatory veto changes would remove the allowances in the formula for school districts who are subject to TIF. To TIFs. For example, the Peoria Journal Star said in one editorial that would mean Peoria schools would lose another $1 million annually. Do you anticipate that would also be true of many districts, these changes proposed to TIF districts?
It would be true in every district that has a TIF district in operation. So every school district that has a tax increment financing district operating within its boundaries, not by the school district, remember, by a municipal or county government, mostly municipal governments, would be adversely affected. So in this change in the governor's veto, he is pitting municipal governments against school districts in direct conflict with each other, that he's putting them both into the boxing ring and he's telling them to duke it out until one of them falls over and the other is left standing. This is a fight that nobody asked for, that nobody wants. What we do in Senate Bill 1 in regards to TIF districts is we charge our review panel of the new formula that has the task of making sure that it's working correctly and coming up with suggested changes. We charge that review panel with the task of trying to come up with a policy rationale, a policy proposal that's well-researched and well-documented to address how TIF districts and school districts interact with each other. What the governor did, though, is quite different. He vetoed the bill without having any inkling of the depth or scope of how this impacts school districts. This is so wide and broad that we're just now getting figures like the one you just cited appropriately from the Peoria public school system. We just heard from the mayor here in Urbana, and she said appropriately that this will pit economic development efforts against the Urbana school district, and it will charge the Urbana school district with taxing property that they are not legally allowed to tax, but still counting that as if they were in the school funding formula. So that's complicated, but it's trickery. The governor's saying, go tax that property, even though you can't, but we're going to count it as if you could, therefore making you appear wealthier than you actually are.
So the Senate's going to be meeting on Sunday with the intention of acting on legislation Are you planning to file a motion on Sunday to override the governor's veto?
Well, to date, I have not filed a motion to override as the sponsor of the bill, which would be the next step. I should be clear, I have no intention of filing a motion to accept. This amendatory veto is not tweaking Senate Bill 1. It's a complete rewrite. It represents a hard right turn on the part of the governor that over time, the provisions of his veto would divest the state from its responsibility of funding public schools. So I can guarantee you that is not going to happen. But I still believe that there is a path toward a reasonable compromise between the proponents and the opponents of Senate Bill 1. And for that reason, I've held off on filing the override motion, because I believe that that path is right in front of us if both sides stick to the principles of trying to make the goal adequately and equitably funding public schools and focus on that. I think there can be a compromise. But if there can't, come Sunday, we as a caucus in the Senate Democratic Caucus, we intend to fix this problem one way or the other. I think the more desired path is to try to find compromise. But if that's not achievable for whatever reason, we are prepared to override the veto.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to just ask a few more questions of State Senator Andy Menar, who's with us, as he's talking about what will be happening on Sunday regarding school funding. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is State Senator Andy Menar. He's been the chief sponsor behind SB 1. Senate Bill 1 has a lot to do with school funding. It has everything to do with how much money school districts are going to get. Yesterday was supposed to be the day that was supposed to happen. So we're talking to him about what's going to happen this week now that Governor Rauner has sent a mandatory veto of Senate Bill 1, made lots of changes to the bill when he vetoed it last week. Senator Menar, you just said that your goal is to have a path to compromise between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party on this, and those who are supporting the changes that the governor made. Do you feel like but it also sounded like you said they have until Sunday. You have until Sunday to kind of work this out. Is that kind of where you guys are at?
Yeah. And here's the reason. The Constitution puts a very hard bookend on the length vetoes can be approved or denied between the legislature and the executive branch. So the reason why Sunday is important is because that is nearing the end of the constitutionally guaranteed time that we have to take up the changes that the governor has suggested. So Sunday is an important day. And we believe, though, again, if cooler heads prevail and if the tenets of adequacy and equity are kept as the focus, not politics, you know, not regional politics pitting downstate versus Chicago and all the other things that are associated with that. But if the tenets of adequacy and equity, which I think most Republicans in the legislature agree with ought to be the goal, if we stick to that, I think we can have a compromise.
So do you feel like that's already expressed in what you wrote in SB 1, or do you feel like you're open to making changes?
Well, I frankly think it is expressed in SB 1. The bill already represents compromise. I should note that, again, I was not the early proponent of the evidence-based model. Senator Berrickman, my colleague, who has worked as many years as I have on this issue, he was the first to introduce the evidence-based model in legislation. I would also note that there are proponents now for Senate Bill 1 that were on opposite sides of this equation for years. So I believe the bill represents compromise today. But nonetheless, people who opposed the bill in the legislature, they got elected just like I did. And they have suggested changes. And I'm asking them to come forward now. Give us those suggestions. If they meet the test of making sure that we have an adequately funded system and an equitably funded system, I believe the Democrats will embrace those suggestions.
You mentioned Republican Senator Jason Barrickman. In the past, both of you together participated in the Edgar Fellows Program at the University of Illinois, which is also wrapping up this week, doing work, talking to the fellows about the bipartisan nature of politics. And I wonder, as you've seen what happened with the budget and overriding the governor, and now, again, perhaps a repeat of that happening with school funding, do you have a sense of how if you feel like it's even further eroding any kind of bipartisan work that's happened in the state house, or do you feel that it's a separate issue between the governor and lawmakers?
I think it's an issue within the Republican Party right now. That's how I view many of these challenges, whether it's a budgetary challenge or, you know, something as important but didn't get as much press as how, you know, we were able to override the governor's veto that put 911 systems in complete jeopardy across the state. That took a coalition of Democrats and Republicans to undo the damage of his veto. I think that can be applied here as well. I believe that there's Republicans, especially downstate Republicans, who approach the job just like I do, that believe that, you know, you're in this business to get things done for the people that you represent. I think they know the difference between right and wrong, and I think they know that this bill is a step in the right direction. But we as lawmakers can't divorce ourselves completely from politics, unfortunately. So those two things are colliding here in a very big way, just like they did on the budget. We hope, again, my preferred path is a compromise. But at the same time, we have to understand that we have been debating this issue for decades in Illinois. And as the debate has raged on, inequity has gotten progressively worse. And if the debate continues, we should only acknowledge that the inequity in the state at this time next year will be worse than it is today, which means that we would allow the hole to get bigger and wider before we decide to get out of it. That's unacceptable to me as a parent. It's unacceptable to me as a lawmaker at this point in time. And I think there's a majority of folks in the legislature who agree on that point. And that's why we believe the time is now. So whether that is because of a compromise or because of an override, that's what we're working for today.
And that's what we'll hear more from you about this on Sunday, right?
Absolutely.
State Senator Andy Menar is a Democrat representing Illinois' 48th district, which includes Bunker Hill, but lots of other areas as well. In studio with us in Urbana, Senator Menar, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
We've heard stories about bed bug infestations for years. More and more, those stories are now coming from central Illinois. And bed bugs are enough of a problem in the Decatur area that they've created a bed bug coalition. We're going to find out now what's driving this problem and what communities are doing about it. Justin Kahn is a reporter with the Decatur Herald and Review. He's been writing about this. He spoke with Scott Cameron earlier this week.
So you write that it's easy to get bed bugs, that it's tough, it's expensive to get rid of them. Why are we hearing more about these bugs in Illinois, and any sense of what's driving it?
You know, that's sort of the mystery, in that there's not, because no government entity really is in charge of ridding the bed bugs or recording, the problem. If there's no, you know,
there's nobody's tracking it, huh?
Nobody's tracking it. So there's really no really way to know why. They happen to have come here now, and you know, they've been here for a while, but Decatur all of a sudden just had a real outbreak of them, and the health department in the city started getting, you know, a lot of calls. And you know, at first the health department was telling people you need to call the city, and the city was telling people you need to call the health department. Well, you know, finally they got together and said, well, it's not under either of our jurisdictions, but we should do something. So they formed the coalition. But as far as, you know, exactly why, it's kind of a mystery.
So obviously people are getting, you know, more used furniture and trading things, you know, eBay and Craigslist and things like that, and free cycle. But you mentioned the Bed Bug Coalition in the Decatur area. What do they do?
Well, so at first they just met, and their original goal was to be able to tell people on the phone what to do. You know, so that would, because that
like
was
like a helpline, you know, kind of a thing. Huh?
Yeah, they wanted to be able to help people. Then over time they started, you know, having goals such as the health department has made two publications now, like pamphlets that first just explaining what bed bugs are and, you know, what can be done. And then the second one is for, that they made, was for home health workers. And I believe both of those are available on the Macon County Health Department website. If you know, people wanted to see and learn more about bed bugs and what you should do if you're a home health worker, because that's a, you know, that's a real issue, you know, and if you're an employee, you know, somewhere and you have to go in these homes that have bed bugs, mm-hmm. you know, it can be scary, and you don't necessarily want to go in and scare, you know, wearing the full bunny suit at every home you go into. Well, I don't want to come into your home because you might have bed bugs.
Might have bed bugs, right. And they can come from anywhere. I mean, you know, hospitals, hotels, if you travel someplace. You know, you one of the articles that you wrote about, they don't discriminate in any way. I mean, anybody, any living anywhere, in any income level, of any background or ethnicity, can get bed bugs.
Absolutely. And they can be anywhere. I think it's one of those things where in writing the story, we wanted to be careful to not, you know, frighten people and say, oh my gosh, don't go outside because you're going to get bed bugs. But at the same time, I do think that a little due diligence does help. You know, have your eye out for them. Definitely check your home. And, you know, but they can, any type of fabric, like if you sit on fabric chairs at your office, they can get in those. So, you know, definitely it's something you have to be aware of. And, you know, and that you can, you know, do something about them. You want to do something about them before they become a bigger problem. That's mm-hmm. that's really the word that they're trying to spread with the Bed Bug Coalition is, you know, don't be ashamed. Get, you know, do something early. Don't wait till it becomes a huge problem, because it can get really expensive.
Yeah, and we're talking about, you know, expense and a lot of those things, because it is, you know, it can be obviously very uncomfortable. It can be expensive. It tends to be an inconvenience, though, I understand, because, you know, you're right. You said earlier that there is not consistent tracking of the bed bugs, and one reason for that, I would imagine, is because they don't carry disease. They're not seen as a health threat.
That's exactly why they're not under anyone's jurisdiction, and why there's not a lot of, you know, and also not a lot of help, you know, government help as far as doing something about the bed bugs, is because, yeah, they don't spread diseases. They're really just a nuisance, but they can be a pretty, you know, they can really cause some psychological damage, because, you know, if you know they're there and they're going to bite you in the middle of the night, it's really difficult to sleep. So, yeah, it's not something, you know, just because it's good that they don't spread diseases, in some ways it's making them, you know, spread more that way. And they're definitely a problem. They're definitely not something that you want to have or spread.
And, you know, there's not hard data on this. You know, there was one, obviously it was referred to as a flawed study, because it was more like a survey for commercial purposes. But Orkin did put out some information, and it's not just Decatur. I mean, they sort of labeled the whole region around there throughout central Illinois as being at least seeing some sort of an uptick, again, from one company, from one survey that they put out sort of as a promotional tool. But as just anecdotally, it seems like this is a problem that's going, you know, far beyond Decatur.
Absolutely. And, you know, that survey, you know, from a company in Orkin that is pretty widespread. I mean, they're everywhere. So you can't, it's not like it's a, you know, there's only those companies in certain places. So that would maybe, you know, make the study not quite as accurate. But it is, like you said, a survey. I think maybe awareness of the bed bugs too could have something, in central Illinois, could have something to do with, you know, more calls that people are making. So like you said, it is flawed, but I do think that it's a sign that it is definitely something that's here. And I know that in Champaign and Springfield, they've went through similar situations. And I like that indicator. You know, the city and the health department have taken that step to try to do something at least. Now, you know, I think education, that's sort of their goal is educating people. And I do think that's the key, is the more people know about it, you know, the better they can handle it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've only got about 30 seconds left here, but why don't we end on that note? I mean, what are some of the things that you found that people need to know?
I think the main thing is if you live in a high-rise apartment building, tell your landlord, tell your property manager, make sure they know about it. And, you know, there are things you can do in your home. pure alcohol. I think 90 something percent alcohol. If you spray that on the bugs, it will kill them. And now you're not going to be able to get rid of, you know, your entire infestation that way. But if you're going, you know, if you see them and you do that, that does help. But really, you know, the main thing is find, you know, tell somebody, make sure you get help. Don't just try to move out of the problem, because that's not going to work, because it gets in your clothes and in your bedding. So I think just making sure you let someone know, or, you know, if it's in your own home, you know, that's where really the problem becomes, because it's so expensive that it's not everybody can afford to do it. But, you know, sometimes you just have to, it's definitely not a thing you can just move away from.
Yeah, it won't just.
If you have the problem, you really need to treat it.
Yeah, it won't just go away on its own. That's Justin Kahn, reporter with Decatur Herald and Review, been writing about the growing issue here with bed bugs throughout Central Illinois. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
The total solar eclipse is now just 10 days away, and one of the best places to see it is in southern Illinois. In case you haven't heard, on August 21st, a total solar eclipse will cover the contiguous United States for the first time since 1979. Cedar Lake, that's just south of Carbondale, is one of the best locations in the world to watch this eclipse. Previously on the 21st, we've learned about how the region's preparing for the big event, which is expected to draw tens or even hundreds of thousands of people to the area. Why is this such a big deal? Here's Phil Plait, known as the Bad Astronomer. We spoke to him on a previous show. He's an astronomer, blogger, head science writer for the Netflix show Bill Nye Saves the World.
Well, it's a big deal for a lot of reasons. One is that it's a rare phenomenon. You don't get a total solar eclipse in any particular spot on the Earth very often. Now, in general, they happen once or twice a year, but they're very specific. There might be one over Antarctica, over the Pacific Ocean. And so to have one over the continental United States hasn't happened in a long time and won't happen again for quite a few years. And the other reason is that this is a profoundly beautiful event. It's not just like a partial solar eclipse where the moon blocks a little bit of the sun. You wouldn't even notice that if you didn't know it was happening. This is the moon completely blocking the face of the sun. It actually starts to get dark out. Crickets will chirp. Birds will come out and sing, sort of twilight afternoon events happening in the middle of the day. And you also see the sun's atmosphere called the corona, which is not something you normally see. You only see it in pictures. And to be able to look and see that with your own eyes is an incredibly moving event. Or so I'm told, because I've never seen one. This will be my first.
That's Phil Plait, head science writer for Bill Nye's Netflix show. He joined us on the 21st last month. Over the next week, we've got some exciting conversations planned. Are you planning to travel to the area of totality to see the sun completely disappear behind the moon and experience more than 2 minutes of total darkness in midday? Here's a few things you should know from science writer Diane Kelly.
Everyone who wants to see the eclipse, I think, should really go try to see the eclipse. They just shouldn't go blindly. So they plan ahead, you know, be prepared. Be prepared for a lot of traffic. The last time we had a coast-to-coast total solar eclipse that was visible in the U.S., it was 1918. So the last time this happened, we had cars, but our roads were terrible. So there certainly were no interstates. So the car tourism was not a big thing at the time. So the ease of travel is attractive for making people want to get, you know, hop in the car and go down. But if enough people hop in their car to go down, we could see some really terrifically huge traffic jams.
That's science writer Diane Kelly. Tune in on Monday and you'll hear more from her. She's going to share some more eclipse how-tos. And if you're planning on attending, we'd love to hear from you. How are you getting ready? What are you most excited about? As always, you can tweet to us at 21STShow. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Coming up, we're going to have a preview of the Illinois State Fair. And what everybody arguably looks forward to most, the food. Stay tuned. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is the 21st.
Possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com. www.thebedbugs.com.
First, thanks for tuning in. The State Fair kicked off yesterday in Springfield, and of all the things to look forward to at the State Fair, food is at the top of the list for many people. And if you really love fair food, there's a new event taking place this year that might pique your interest. Every day for the next 10 days, there will be competitive eating contests featuring fair food favorites like sweet corn, French fries, mini donuts, and more. We're joined on the line now from Springfield by Brian Groves. He's Vice President of Consumer Sales and Marketing for the State Journal Register, which is sponsoring the Illinois State Fair Eating Contest. It kicks off this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Brian, welcome to the 21st.
Great to be there.
So, Brian, I think when you think of the State Fair, I bet your earliest memories of the fair are also food. Maybe not food competitions, but definitely food, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mini donuts and everything that goes along with the fair. I love fair food. And, you know, unfortunately, yeah, some of it's not so healthy, but I love to go there and take advantage of the food every single year.
What's your favorite food at the fair?
I love the mini donuts.
The
hot mini donuts with cinnamon and sugar on them. You can't beat that. It's the best thing they have. There's so much wonderful stuff there. I mean, you know, pork chop sandwiches, ribeye. I mean, there's so much great stuff to eat. But, you know, since I was a kid, I've loved that mini donut.
So, Brian, there are people who love to eat, and then there are people who love to competitively eat, right? And so what kind of things? I know there's a watermelon contest that starts today at 3 o'clock. Can people competitively eat all the things you just talked about, like pork chop sandwiches or the mini donuts?
Absolutely. Something new every day. So, you know, we have corn dogs on Saturday, cantaloupe on Sunday. We need more entries on the cantaloupe. That was the one entry that we don't have a lot of. We have everything else. We were packed. We have a wonderful group of people involved in this, except for the cantaloupe. We need some more on the cantaloupe.
How many? Do you have a limit? How many people can competitively eat cantaloupe, for example?
We have a limit. I think, we need probably 3 or 4 more people to really have a really good stock, you know, to get a good number in there. We have enough to go, but we would like to have, you know, a decent number to move forward on the cantaloupe. I don't know if cantaloupe, I'm not sure why cantaloupe was the one, but we just haven't had as many response. Mini donuts is on there Monday, the first Monday of the fair. Sweet corn, sponsored by the Illinois Growers Association. Pork chop sandwich, French fries, ribeye sandwich, and then the Golden Egg contest winner. So we State Fair, this is the fourth year we sponsored another contest, which we have our finals today at 3 o'clock, which will be at the Lincoln Stage, so almost the same time as the competitive eating is going on. But we do have, so we have another contest, and that winner will also be part of the competitive eating contest. The winner will, we have a people's choice also, so if you're going around the fair and you want to text the winner, there's a number on each one of the booths, and text 217-441-2700, and you can, whatever vendor you enjoy the most, you can enter their number, and they will win a prize. So we're excited about that. This is our fourth annual one, so we're excited about that food contest also.
So that's for the people. So that's for the vendors selling food the fair.
Exactly.
Everyone who's there not competitively eating can, or maybe just their own competition with themselves, right? You can
exactly.
try. You can
how,
do
how many? Yeah, exactly.
Right. You can kind of do a taste
the
of
goal,
all the
goal
food.
Of that. The goal of that program 4 years ago was to kind of get some new and unique items to the fair, and I think we've done that. We've got some, you know, new. And some of the stuff has been really good. I mean, we've done a horchata shake, which is that one last year that was just amazing. You know, you wouldn't think that would be that good. It's some kind of grain, Mexican. I mean, it was amazing. It was at the
Village. So the horchata shake that won before that one
last
is like
year.
A People's
yep.
Choice.
That
okay,
last year. Yeah.
And did it? And I see some other winners were like chimichangas as well. So it's like just trying to get lots of other different food into the fair too.
New foods at the vendors. So you know, we're trying to promote food. And the last day of the fair is the funnel cake contest. So you can still go to Illinois State Fair's website. Some of them are still open. I'm not sure exactly which ones are open right now, but get on there, sign up, and we'll let you know whether you can be part of it or not.
Who's thinking about this, Brian, does the competition work exactly?
So the competition works so they have points for every item consumed. So and the like French fries and some of the other stuff, it's kind of a weight, like they weigh it before and whoever's, you know, and then they weigh it after and they decide how much, you know, whoever consumed the most weight. Otherwise, it's a point system. So, you know, one corn dog, that's a point. You have water. Water can be there. It's 5 minutes to consume the most food. So you have 5 minutes to whoever consumes the most in 5 minutes. and had the most, that will be the winner of that round. Some have two and three rounds, so we have, you know, it'll be whoever consumes. We'll have to do a couple different couple. We'll have to do a semifinal and a final, but for the most part, we'll get it done pretty quickly. But
so when you get to the final round of corn dogs, like how much corn dogs are people consuming in 5 minutes?
I will be honest with you. I will tell you on Sunday. I have no idea. This is new to the fair. It's new to us. So, and this is the thing that Rebecca Clark and I talked about from the fair is this is every fair does this, and the Illinois State Fair is kind of coming to a little late to this, but we're excited to be part of it. But I think that I don't know how many people. I have no idea how many people are going to how many corn dogs consume. That's what makes it kind of exciting. I mean, I have no idea how much watermelon will be consumed at 3 o'clock today. So we're kind of excited to see how it all works out.
Okay. So some of our producers were looking over the contest rules, and they noticed that if you're a contestant, you're allowed to do something that's known as chipmunking. Can you explain what that means?
I think it means that, and I'm not a competitive eating expert, but I think it means, I think the food is, the too much food is falling out of your mouth or not getting all the way in. You know, you kind of like throw it around your mouth. You have to actually eat the whole amount of food. So I looked it up. I wasn't sure when I saw the rules. And I think that's what it means, is you got to make sure everything is swallowed and out and through your mouth. You can't, or throw it back up again. I think, so I'm not 100% sure.
I think it means like you can have it in your mouth as long as it's right in your mouth before the time expires, yeah, right?
Exactly. You have
then
to
it counts,
it.
Yeah, but you have exactly to swallow it.
So, exactly.
Okay, that's
too much. It can't like be falling out of your mouth. So.
Right. Since you brought it up, what happens if someone throws up?
It doesn't count. So the rules are, if a competitor regurgitates any food, they will be disqualified. So
okay.
So if you do throw up, you'll be automatically disqualified. So,
do you guys have – I know this is super gross, but do you have contingency plans for people throwing up, especially since it's the first time you've done this? Are there like – are there
– I think there is. I'm pretty sure there is.
Okay.
We haven't got there yet today, and we'll get there at 3 o'clock, and I'm sure they got plenty of contingency plans.
Okay, this sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, though, huh, Brian? Hopefully,
yeah, I think so. And I guess, I asked the same question to a couple people before we got part of this: is how many people throw up? And then a lot of these people, you know, they nobody pushes themselves too far to get to that point. So hopefully, we don't have any incidents. And you know, stuff like watermelon should be relatively easy to eat. You know, you can't eat enough watermelon in 5 minutes to throw up, I hope. So we'll see. It'll be fun to see.
And is there a prize, or do you just have the glory of winning the watermelon eating contest?
A big ribbon that you can take and put on your mantle at home and show everyone that you are a competitive eating champion. So we do give a ribbon to the winner. So there's in the I think there is something. I think it's mostly just the ribbon and being. And you'll get some media for it, so you'll be announced as a winner in the SJR and on the website, so you'll get lots of some media.
Lots of State Journal Register coverage.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us. It's Brian Groves. He's Vice President of Consumer Sales and Marketing for the State Journal Register. They're sponsoring the Illinois State Eating Fair Contest that kicks off this afternoon, as he's been talking to us about. Brian, thanks so much for being with us.
Enjoyed it.
As we continue this conversation on State Fair food, let's go now to that winner of last year's food vendor contest. On the line with us from Springfield is Lindsay De Los Santos. She's the co-owner of Sergio's Cantina. It's a family business based in Geneva in Chicago's west suburbs. Of course, she's in Springfield now, where it's day two of the Illinois State Fair. Lindsay, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I should start off by asking you, the State Fair started yesterday. How'd it go? How was your first day?
Actually, it was great. The weather was nice. It was busier than it was last year. You know, last year we had some rain and it was quite a bit slower. So, so far, so good.
Yeah, it's great to have the good weather. Now, last year you all won. We were just talking about this, the State Food Fair People's Choice Food Contest with your horchata shake. Can you describe what that is for us? For people who, it sounds like, people might have heard of horchata, but maybe not a shake.
Yeah, so we did make a version of we make our horchata homemade, and we turned it into a milkshake, and we served it with whipped cream on top and a churro.
So it sounds like you made it portable so you can walk around. Is that kind of the key with fair food, is food that you can walk around and eat or drink?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I should mention, though, you guys are actually two-time champions, because in 2014, you all also won the contest for your chimichurri steak taco. Is that correct? Are you guys selling that this year, too?
Yep, yep. We're selling both items that won from last year and then 2 years ago. So, yeah, the chimichurri steak taco is a big popular selling item. We were also featured, Sergio was featured on the Food Network and the Cooking Channel at the State Fair making it, and then also at a different festival making it, too.
Wow. So that sounds like it's great publicity for you guys for your restaurant. I was wondering how hard it must be to move operations from Chicago's west suburbs down to Springfield. How do you guys manage that? How do you figure out how to do that? You guys have been doing it for a couple of years, but that must be a tough thing to do.
Yeah, you know, at this point, it's not too much of an issue. We do other festivals in the Chicago area throughout the summer. So basically, we have to, you know, rent a big moving truck, and we load up all of our equipment, and we get about six people from our staff, and we just stay down here, you know, have them based in a hotel down here for 11 days. And so it's, you know, we're kind of used to it doing the other festivals.
Yeah, is this one a little longer than normal? I mean, in terms of your food vending supplies, is that something that you get in Springfield, or do you just sort of make arrangements to have that brought down regularly also?
Yeah. So our other festivals are about 3 days, and we do bring a bunch of food down, but there are vendors that we can order from here, and they'll deliver them actually to our stand. So it makes it pretty easy and convenient.
So I know yesterday was the first day also of the fourth annual Golden Abe Fantastic Food Contest. What food items did you guys enter this year?
Yeah, so this year was a little bit different because they have now a sweet entry, and then they have a savory entry. So we did enter one for each category, and we have the key lime custard, key lime flan custard that we made, and then we also made Mexican corn and carnitas. Those were our two entries.
Okay, how'd it go?
We're keeping our fingers crossed. We didn't hear anything, so we don't know if they're going to announce the winners of those categories today, or if they did announce them. So we don't know anything yet. We did put in a call yesterday to the office, and they said that they were still working on it. So hopefully
you'll hear today. Yeah. My producers are telling me the final judging is this afternoon. So I understand the panel of judges will include the mayor of Springfield, the Illinois Fair Queen, and local celebrities. That event is at 3:00 and open to the public. I imagine you're also going to be, that's probably a pretty busy time for you guys running the booth also.
Yeah, today, as long as the weather's nice, things should be heating up today and tomorrow, you know, starting kicking off the weekend. So, yeah, it'll be a busy time around 3:00.
What's your favorite fair food? Is it everything at Sergio's Cantina, or do you also have a good time sampling all the other food that's available?
Yeah, you know, we do have a good time sampling other food. There's a booth that has a steak sandwich that we like. So we just, you know, we kind of go around and try other foods. We're pretty used to our food. Yeah, so it's fun for us as well, you know, seeing what else is out there.
That's Lindsay De Los Santos. She's the co-owner of Sergio's Cantina. They're based in Geneva, out on the west side of the Chicago suburbs, but they're in Springfield. They'll be one of the many food vendors available for the Illinois State Fair. And as they said, People's Choice winner last year, won before, and we'll see what happens this year. Best of luck to you, Lindsay.
All right. Thanks so much. Yeah, come visit us in the Ethnic Village. We're the Mexican booth there.
In addition to the food, of course, there's lots of music at the fair, lots of great acts. We'll tweet out all the links to all the bands that are playing, everything from Jason Derulo to Alabama to John Mellencamp, and next Tuesday, Sublime with Rome with Blues Traveler. So let's go out and end today's show with a little bit of Sublime.
Early in the morning, rising to the street.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Remember, we want to hear from folks who are headed to the eclipse to see that. So please post on Facebook and let us know if that's something you're planning to do. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.